Welcome, and thanks for listening to Intrinsic Investigations. My name is Mr. Olivo, and I created this podcast because I've been fortunate enough over the last decade to see unique and thought-provoking projects happen in my classroom, and we wanted a place to showcase them. The true heart of this podcast lies not in the content discovered, but in exploring the personal stories of these young researchers as they journey through uncharted and unfamiliar intellectual terrain. By sharing their stories, we hope to normalize the challenges and frustrations that come with independent research, and also share those moments where students transcend the normal grind of the school day to discover concepts that range from the global to deeply personal. We will begin with a brief introduction to the student of focus, why they picked their topic, and discuss their growth over the course of the last year. It should be mentioned that the opinions expressed in this podcast in no way reflect the opinions of our school district, Bergen County Technical Schools and Special Services, or our school itself, Bergen County Technical High School Teterboro, or the College Board. The work detailed in this podcast was most likely completed in AP Capstone, but this podcast is in no way affiliated with the College Board. In this episode, Bela explores type 1 diabetes stigma in film. I'm joined in this episode by Bela, who is going to introduce herself right now before we get into her work involving type 1 diabetes. So feel free to tell the people whatever they need to know to understand you and where this conversation is going to go, Bela.
Okay, so my name is Bela. I am a junior in the law and justice major at the school. My research focuses on media representation of type 1 diabetes, which is a disability where an individual cannot produce the hormone insulin, so they have to take regulated insulin pump therapy and measure their glucose, aka blood sugar, through finger pricks or monitors. And so the point of my content analysis was to look for specific codes in media representation, specifically in adolescent movies.
So why type 1 diabetes? Why look at that?
So I'll just be very upfront about it. I have that disability, and I've always been curious about disability representation, especially because what often happens in the field of disability representation is people who don't have the disability play the role. But it's interesting, if you look at another field of representation, you wouldn't have a white character play an Asian American character. But when it comes to disabilities, you can have an able-bodied person, someone without a disability, play someone with a separate disability. And so it can cause a lot of construed representation and harms being perpetuated, because that's an experience that you're just relying on stereotypes to portray.
And when you first started looking into this, were there particular papers or sources or movies that were inspiring for you to start this type of work?
Yeah, so first point, the papers. So I had an excellent expert advisor. Her name's Dr. Katz. She works up at McGill. And so she actually runs a whole section on specifically diabetes research, and she did a lot of content analysis, which was the base of my work, and I kind of built upon what she did. And so something that she looked at, which I further explored, was especially movies such as The Babysitter's Club, which is pretty well known. A lot of people know it. It's a adolescent television show and a movie. I focused on the movie from 1995, especially because of how much older it is now. It's good to see some contrast between now and then representation. So that's something that also sparked my interest, and especially with Netflix coming out with the show in 2020. So it's interesting to see how the representation has progressed.
Were you aware of the Babysitter's Club movie and the character with type 1 diabetes from the 1990s prior to doing this work? Or this was the first time you watched this film?
I didn't even know, even though I'd read some of the books, that type 1 diabetes really was a thing until I was diagnosed myself. And that's probably because no one talks about it. And when there is a mention of diabetes, it's as heavily associated with type 2, which is can be influenced by certain genetic factors, but it can also rely a lot on environmental factors. While type 1 diabetes is pretty much strictly genetic based.
All right. So obviously deeply personal, but again, you're using that academic research outside of there to try to understand this phenomenon as well. What do you think was a preconceived notion you had going into this work that changed as a result of doing the work?
So obviously, as a person with disability, I was expecting different representation. I expected more stigmatized, surprisingly. But so I had 5 selected codes, and one of them was being ashamed of managing in public, or people who don't have diabetes not trusting you to manage it yourself. And I actually didn't expect that to be the most prevalent code of all of my research. In fact, I was expecting it to be something like wanting to be normal, which is quite, you know, regular for teenagers who have something that may point them out as a little different. But so I came in with this notion that I was going to see a lot of these characters want to feel normal. And then I ended up finding out that a lot of it was actually other people without diabetes influencing the character's life. And what became of that was the character was only known for having diabetes. They didn't have a separate storyline to them.
So what did that look like for them? Everybody just talked about, oh, insert character's name XYZ. And that was just...
Yeah.
The diabetes was the driving plot force the entire time for them.
There's like a term for this. So I defined it in my abstract. It's called tokenism. And it's like when you include a character strictly for diversity, but you don't give them anything else other than their diversity factor. So it's like, let's say I include a person from a marginalized community, but the whole point of their character is that they're there for diversity. So they don't have any character building. They don't get much dialogue beyond just talking about why they're there in the first place. And so you could see that, for example, like in Greenland, which is one of the movies that I analyzed, when the boy was mentioned, he was only really mentioned regarding insulin and pump site changes and continuous glucose monitors. No one actually treated him like a person. And so I also saw that replicated in a few other areas, like in Babysitter's Club, a lot of her conversations surrounded about diabetes and things. Like, I think there was only maybe one or two conversations where she had, which was separate from that. And so that also makes it seem like the only thing someone can be with a disability is their disability.
So now in seeing what you discovered through your content analysis in these three movies, was it three?
Yeah.
So it was Greenland, Babysitter's Club, and...
Purple Hearts.
I am unfamiliar with all of these movies, so I'm going to take your word for it, because it seems like you know what you're talking about here after a year of watching them. So after viewing these movies, do you see either type 1 diabetes representation or problematic representation of disabilities frequently in other forms of media or film itself?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially, like, in terms of television, I didn't get to do that because of time constraints, and it would have been a little difficult to watch 40-minute episodes and four or five of them, plus having to do that for, like, 10 other movies or 10 other shows. And so I myself did not look at other pieces, but when I was looking for other, like, research papers that were going to either corroborate or disagree with my results, one of which was Dr. Katz, Dr. Brazeau, a couple of other people to name a few, they actually looked at television and they saw very similar results. In fact, in television, they saw worsened results, especially adult television and adult movies. So teenage representation is rough, but I think it's improving. But in adult, a lot of it's just treated as a joke. And it's like diversity doesn't really matter at that point. And
like the type 1 diabetes is treated as a joke?
Yes. Like, there was a movie where it's like, I think it was Hansel and Gretel. I don't know. It was like an adult, like, it was like a rated R, something like that. And it was like a joke or a play on something. And I remember like a character was experiencing hypoglycemia, which is a low blood sugar. And the joke was to give them insulin. But if you did that in real life, that would be detrimental and deadly because insulin lowers the blood sugar.
Right. So that medical intervention was played off for laughs.
Yes. And it was incorrect.
Well, I hope no one's watching Hansel and Gretel and assuming that it's medically accurate diabetes intervention.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope so too.
Okay. So when you approach this, those three movies, how did you pick them?
So I went to a general news website first. It's called Beyond Type 1, and I just did a very simple Google search. I was like, what are some movies that have type 1 diabetic characters? And so I got a list of 10, which was perfect. I put them on a Google Sheets. I put the 10 movies down. I assigned just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, lined them up going down, used Google's random number generator and selected 3 and just went with that. And so some of the inclusion criteria had to be that, one, it was in English. Two, preferably if it had captions, which was great, and most of them did. Three, if I could find the script online. Four, there had to be obviously a character with type 1 diabetes. And five, it had to either be rated PG or PG-13.
When you did your content analysis, which was qualitative, was it quantitative and qualitative?
Qualitative and quantitative, kind of a mix of both.
Okay, so it was mixed method. And you started looking at the data and the trends that were apparent in the work. I know you mentioned the most prominent code that you mentioned earlier was what again?
It's like when people without diabetes distrust the person with diabetes to manage their condition.
What were other things that popped out in terms of representation here or how the disease was represented in the characters?
So another thing that's important to note, I guess, in terms of my research is that I didn't really take into account of other factors that could play a role. So for example, race and sex and socioeconomic status, I just didn't have the time to really do enough diving into that. But certain things that I did notice in like other codes, which I think were somewhat heavily related to that, was feeling angry or distressed. And what I found is that a lot of the anger and distress was not necessarily from having diabetes, but actually from insurance. And it was the insurance struggles. And it was then replicated into their personal lives, the characters' personal lives, where other people would start blaming the person with diabetes for an insurance struggle and makes it look like it's that person's fault.
So in these movies, it isn't even just the physical toll of managing symptoms. It's the actual financial toll of trying to deal with insurance.
Yeah. And what would happen is when obviously you're dealing with insurance, which I'm sure a lot of people can attest to, is not always easy. What happens is the person gets blamed instead of the insurance company themselves. And that's what I saw happen in Purple Hearts. Cassie, the main character's name, was blamed because she didn't get her insulin vial renewed or ready again to get picked up. And her mother started yelling at her about not being able to manage anything, and again, connecting back to the code of distrust, so there's some intersectionality there, while Cassie herself was experiencing anger and distress because she's like, why are you blaming me when it's the insurance company and, you know, the healthcare system, and it's, you know, like, it's not my fault. And so watching that, obviously, not only is a person with diabetes, but as a human, it's like, that's a pretty dehumanizing experience.
When trying to carry out this content analysis, which I'm going to say is quite different than probably other long-term projects you've encountered in school, what were the biggest challenges for you in terms of trying to really see deep patterns in what was occurring in these films?
Yeah, so I actually had to struggle with this, and I don't know if the audience knows what a prep is, but it's basically just an assignment you get every month that you have to fill out. It's just like a reflection process to make sure you're on the right track. And so one of the questions I think on the prep actually had me sitting there for a while and had me reflecting on my methods, especially the analysis portion, because when you're doing qualitative data, you have to make sure that when you're doing the analysis, it's not overly biased or overly personal. And especially as a person with disability, I had to take into account of my own bias and norms. So what I tried to do is that I tried to do multiple rounds. So the first thing I noticed that I could do to ameliorate that is scan the codes going through the dialogue on the movie as I'm watching it. Then do something called thick description. So looking at characters' actions or lack of action and how that could be playing into their intentions and how this can be interpreted with other pieces of media. So my first attempt of writing out literally my own discussion paper, like the discussion portion of the paper, it was rough because literally all of it was opinion based. And so it took me a while and the help of my classmates to realize that I have to connect this to other sources and start to corroborate what I found or find patterns and themes through that. It's not just what I think. It's about how does this connect to the greater scope of research. So I had to realize that discussion portions are not, especially with content analysis, because there's no numbers, like about kind of seeing, hey, is there something similar here? Is there a similar usage here? And so one of the papers I cited, I think it was by Dr. Jung or something, where someone conducted an interview study, and I actually found a perfect quote from someone that aligned with a perfect piece of dialogue, and that was like, I figured it out, I got it. And so I finally started to do it like that. So I took pieces and quotes of different research papers, like compared them to mine. I mean, you read the paper, like you probably, you know what I'm kind of referring to.
Yeah, and if I'm wrong in my summary, you let me know, but you were using interviews from peer-reviewed sources where people with type 1 diabetes were expressing their sentiments about managing T1D. And then you were trying to see where do those real-life, interview, peer-reviewed-based results, how do they line up with what was happening in the films you were watching, which were fictionalized?
And those interview studies were studies where people with diabetes came out to talk about stigma. So interestingly enough, right. All these quotes were literally experiences of stigma. So when you saw that replicated in a movie, it's like, okay, so there is a pattern here, you know? And it's ironic because one of the quotes that I looked at was nearly identical nearly identical. And so I feel like that's when I started to get the hang of a content analysis and starting to draw themes, because without numbers, it's kind of hard to do. Like I didn't do a stats test, so I kind of had to draw conclusions somewhat on my own using what I had.
Right, you had to triangulate with other sources to see if there was some kind of corroboration outside of your own personal experience, which it seems like you did that. You didn't just rely on your own experience and make, as you pointed out, just an opinion piece.
Yeah.
So there was this striving, obviously content analysis is subjective, but there was a striving for objectivity baked into the methods that you tried.
Yes.
Great. You mentioned earlier the help of your peers in trying to help check your opinion. So where do you feel like that specifically helped? Was there any instances where you can point to, oh yeah, this person showed me that I was viewing this a bit myopically, like maybe I had a little bit of tunnel vision. What did that look like?
Yeah, so there's a couple of classmates like in this room where they had gone through my paper. And something they noticed that especially, so I've taken some classes which talk about some complex themes. For example, I took women and gender studies, public policy, criminology, like a bunch of classes which some people consider a little more progressive. So I've kind of understood how ableism can play a role in our day-to-day lives. But trying to put that onto a paper and articulate it, I realized to my audience may not sound the most non-biased. And so I was able to have people look at my paper and be like, okay, this makes no sense to me. I don't really know what this means. Isn't this a little bit of a stretch? And I started to realize that the pattern was I wasn't exactly referencing other peer-reviewed studies. I put them in quotation marks or like parenthetical citations, but I never really was like, in this study, in this method, you can see a similar theme and actually talk about the similarities. And so I had classmates literally point that out, and I had to realize that it's great that I have background knowledge and other things, but you have to be important where you apply it, because otherwise it can turn into an opinion piece that you can just find on like New York Times.
Yeah, you know, it's research, so your editorializing should be minimal.
Yeah.
What do you think is, what part of this project do you think you're going to take with you into the future? Like what skills or what, maybe skills, it could be skills or it could be information. Like, what do you feel like is going to be, was most impactful and will be most impactful moving forward?
So I took AP Seminar. So I've had you for 2 years. I really like this class. I feel like it taught me a lot about myself and certain things that I am happy about. So a thing that I learned from this entire process is obviously I'm going to take my paper with me. I'm pretty proud of it. It took a lot of years.
And you should be. Yeah.
Took a lot of weeks and took a lot of months. So I love my paper. But something that I plan to take besides just the physical copy of that is definitely the skills of determination and just being consistent. Because what I realized is that I was very lucky where I just never dealt with procrastination. I actually do the opposite, procrastination. I try to get everything done immediately. And that
I'm
can,
a big fan of that one myself.
Yeah, but like then you like rush through it. And
yeah,
so
no, then you got to fix your mistakes. But
it was this class like kind of forced me to sit down and take it time by time and actually think about it. And one of the most meaningful moments I had in this class was actually me sitting down and I was like, I don't know what to do about this analysis. I feel like I'm too biased. I'm too opinionated. It's not working. So I tried to actually write it out. I tried to write an email to my expert advisor. And that's when I realized for like 3 days straight, I just tried to write it out. I tried to write it out. And I was like, you know what? Yeah, this is me. I'm going to have to do more work at home. Fine. But if I can do it correctly and realize I actually care about this, there's an intrinsic motivation here to do well, I realized it's worth it. And so I'm a person who really likes to, I think the term is philomath, but it's like someone who loves to learn for the sake of learning. So I was like, even though I have to struggle, maybe I'll take a hit on a grade. But if it means that in the long term, I'll find out something I really enjoy and I can really take this even further, I'll do it. And so I think this class just taught me to stay true to what you value in and stay determined and don't give up. And there's resources around you to help you.
Yeah, that's big too. Well, that was eloquently said. I think the other issue is that's hard to do. It's hard to sustain that determination. It's also very different when most classes are structured in a way where there's minimal independence, and then all of a sudden that independence is thrust on you. So relying on others, I mean, it sounds like you really tried to be open to dealing with the shifts that could occur. Having an expert advisor, emailing them when in need, talking to your peers, checking yourself, even being self-reflective and critical about what occurred over the course of the process. Is there anything, what are your future career plans? Is there anything involving T1D or content analysis in the future, or this was very much a now thing? Like, you wanted to do this now, it might not be related to whatever you do for work later in life. Where does this go?
So I'm someone who's going to go probably do my undergrad in public health. I'm not sure where.
Oh, okay.
But I'm planning on doing public health undergrad and then going to med school and becoming an emergency medicine physician. So pretty weird path, but I think it will continue. I think it's important to talk about how disability representation can then set the stage for policy, because if you don't have, like, if your only experience with dealing with someone who has a disability is through seeing it online, and just let's say that online representation is so skewed and inaccurate to what someone actually feels, to like a dehumanizing point, it can influence how effective policy can really be. And so that's where I think my public health passion comes in, and I plan to pursue it there. So I'm going to have to do more probably research on this, and where I plan to go to college, I think there's a lot of access as well for undergraduate research. And then if I end up going medicine, I would love to also kind of raise awareness to other genetic disorders in my free time, and maybe one day open up a clinic in a lower income area of the city, or New York City, I guess. So there's more access to things like, you know, medication, where, et cetera, you know, insurance is a pretty hard place. And so privatized healthcare is also pretty rough. So that's where I plan to go right now. But if I don't go into that and I stick with public health, this isn't going to leave me.
It's so strange that you mention that, because the first content analysis, it wasn't in this class, but the first content analysis I ever saw at the school was done by a student at their internship, where it was in the public health sphere, because it was analyzing readability and word choice in breast cancer pamphlets. So they had to do a content analysis under the guidance of the person running their internship to try to determine how readable the pamphlet was for the general population. And what if you're dealing with someone who's trying to read it and maybe they have a fifth grade reading level? Are we actually overshooting what they could know about a disease that they have? So it's so content analysis, oddly enough, the first time I was introduced to it was in a public health context.
Yeah, I think especially with clinical trials,
yeah.
I was very lucky. My parents knew what that was, and we were given the resources immediately as I was diagnosed, and I was also older. I was 13, and they were like, you know what, like, hey, let's just do some, you know, let's look at stuff, like, why not? But the biggest issue right now when it comes to clinical trials isn't necessarily getting them approved through the IRB board, but it's getting people, and so a lot of it definitely has to do with readability, so.
Awesome. Any final words of advice for anyone who's looking to engage in original student research at this school, at another school? Just what would you tell them?
If you're never uncomfortable in the process, you're doing something wrong.
Ouch. Okay. All right. Elaborate.
There should be moments where you doubt yourself or you feel like something's off, because if you don't, you're never going to be able to check back for yourself. But also, it's normal to feel like something is wrong. And how do you manage that? Like I said, there was 3 days literally in this class that I just sat there and I couldn't type up one email. But that uncomfortable process forced me to become a better thinker of my own research and forced me to adapt to struggles, which I'm going to have to do with in any sphere in my life. So it sounds harsh. Yeah, like, no one wants to be uncomfortable, but it's okay to slowly get used to it and be like, it's an uncharted territory. If it's your first time, even if it's your 10th time, each time it's something new, and each time life's going to throw different curveballs at you. So just be ready, be adaptable, use your support and community, and be ready to feel not okay. It's okay not to be okay.
That's how you get to be okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And on that, thank you, Bela. Great interview, and thank you for listening.
Thank you.